From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Medicaid, America's health care safety net for the poor, has every trend against it these days. Health care costs are soaring. Prescription drugs cost a fortune. An aging population needs more attention than ever. Business is looking to duck health care spending. The ranks of the poor have grown. And to this perfect storm of health care challenges, the state of Florida is pushing a radical experiment: privatization. The state is moving to hand Medicaid over to private managed care organizations, which, according to Governor Jeb Bush, will crack down on fraud and head off the expensive, dire straits of serious illness. Critics say the plan simply sweeps life and death care decisions for the poor out of the public view. A slew of states are watching Florida to see if they might follow. This hour, On Point, America's health care for the poor and Florida's out-of-the-box experiment with Medicaid. We begin in Washington, where the Senate Finance Committee yesterday approved $10 billion in Medicaid and Medicare spending cuts. Julie Rovner is health policy correspondent for National Public Radio. She joins me now from Washington. Julie, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
So here we are, 50 million low-income Americans depending on Medicaid. States and federal government finance it jointly. It's giving everybody fits. Why, Julie?
Well, as you mentioned, it's sort of the quadruple whammy of when the economy goes down, more people qualify for Medicaid. They're supposed to. That's why it's a safety net program. Employers, as you mentioned, are trying to cut back or reduce their health care expenses, sometimes pushing people off, and they end up qualifying for Medicaid. Health care costs are rising for everyone, particularly prescription drug costs. And, of course, for the states, it's been particularly difficult because when the economy goes down, their revenues go down. So it's harder. They don't have the money to finance Medicaid. And I think that's really what's been going on.
So Medicaid for the poor, Medicare for older Americans, what's the split, the ratio? How much of the Medicaid tab does the federal government pick up? How much falls on those stressed state budgets?
Well, it varies. Nationally, it's about 55%. The federal government pays about 55%. The states pay about 45%. But it varies in the poorer states. The federal government picks up a larger share, up to nearly 80% in some of the very poorest states like Mississippi and Alabama. In most of the wealthier states, it's split 50-50, New York, California, the states that are doing better. But it's tricky because the states get to their federal requirements for certain people to be covered and certain services to be covered. But a lot of it is left up to the states to decide who they want to qualify and what services they want to offer within those federal guidelines.
And the states getting very worried about who they're going to cover now when Medicaid, as a portion of some state budgets, total budgets, has become a real substantial percentage.
It has. Last year, it passed education in many states for the first time. That was a real sort of bellwether and a warning bell, I think, for a lot of governors, that they're spending more on Medicaid than they are on education, and that something really has to change, the governors have been saying all year.
So what's going on in Washington right now, Julie, that has these big whacks being taken out of Medicaid and Medicare?
Well, this is a sort of a different exercise. This is the federal budget exercise that we call budget reconciliation. And as part of the budget, we haven't had one of these, sort of a really full-scale budget bill since 1997. So this is the first time we've seen this in several years. And the idea is to save money in entitlement spending. And, of course, Medicare and Medicaid are two of the biggest entitlements, along with Social Security. The Senate Finance Committee, interestingly enough, met its $10 billion goal. It was ordered to find $10 billion in savings. Took about half from Medicare, about half from Medicaid. But they did it in sort of a clever way. They really didn't hit any beneficiaries. They kept Medicaid benefits intact. They kept Medicare benefits intact. They really took it mostly out of providers and out of some other sort of loophole closures. And in some cases, you know, some budget sleights of hand that we like to talk about where they moved payment from one year into the next to make it look like they're spending a little bit less. The House, on the other hand, is looking at a much different package.
And they're talking about $35 billion taken out of these perhaps over the next 5 years. Will that be shifted in some part to the states then? Is that why the states are cowering so?
Well, no, they're talking about $35 billion total in entitlement savings.
Right.
So that's not just – originally it was – they weren't going to open Medicare at all because the Republicans were worried about people wanting to get in and tinker with the drug benefit. So it was supposed to come just from Medicaid. But the moderate Republicans on the Finance Committee said that they wouldn't go along with that. So they insisted that there be some changes to Medicare. It's hard to – I mean, a lot of these costs, if the House has its way, will be passed along to beneficiaries. The House is looking at raising costs for low-income beneficiaries – cutting some benefits or allowing states to cut some benefits, and making it harder for seniors who are very poor to get both Medicare and Medicaid to get long-term care. So it depends what they end up with, who the costs will be passed along to.
And Julie, finally, in a nutshell, how does this tussle, this debate over Medicaid, fit into the sort of bigger national conversation about what the whole country is going to do with its soaring health care costs?
Well, I think what Florida is doing, and you're right, there are a number of states not just watching it, but there are several states that are just barely behind, Georgia and South Carolina, who are developing similar types of plans. And basically, I think what's going on in Florida and what's going on in Washington, to some extent, is trying to shift the risk, if you will, for health inflation from the people who are paying for it now, that being the government and employers, to the people who are consuming it, the patients. And that's the idea behind this Florida plan, is that you would limit how much Medicaid pays to these managed care companies and let the managed care companies decide how they're going to distribute that money. So basically, that puts the managed care company and the patient at risk if health costs keep going up. And there's a hope that if you shift more of the cost to consumers, that they'll be able to put the brakes on health care spending. I don't know that anybody's actually demonstrated that yet.
Of course, in the meantime, those patients we're talking about are by definition poor and not loaded with assets to respond to that. We're going to look at exactly what's going on in Florida. Julie Rovner, we thank you for the big national picture. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Julie Rovner, health policy correspondent for NPR. She joined me from Washington. We turn now to the state of Florida, where Governor Jeb Bush's drive to effectively privatize Medicaid has received authorization from the Federal Department of Health and Human Services. I'm joined from Tallahassee, Florida, by Alan Gomez, Capitol reporter for the Palm Beach Post. Alan, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, no problem.
So it is an experiment that's been signed off by the federal government here. What is the experiment that's proposed, Alan?
Well, it's a five-year waiver demonstration, which they're going to phase in throughout the state over those 5 years. And in a nutshell, what they're doing is shifting more of the Medicaid recipients into private managed care organizations and what they're calling provider service networks, yet to be created, groups of doctors, physicians, that sort of thing.
So that means if it's signed off on by the Florida legislature, and that hasn't happened yet, it starts in Broward and Duval counties. These are rather poor counties around Miami and Jacksonville, and they would no longer have the kind of open access to Medicaid, but rather they would be funneled into the equivalent of HMOs?
Exactly. The big thing with this change is that where before, there are already plenty of HMOs working in Medicaid. But right now, the state determines what we refer to down here as the amount, duration, and scope of services.
Mm-hmm.
What happens now is that burden is shifted over to the private companies, where they will be able to determine how many different kinds of services and what sort of limits to place on these services.
How's it being received in Florida? Who's saying what?
Yeah, it's a mixed bag right now. The governor proposed this thing, and then the legislature pretty much has let them go along with it so far. They're still waiting for the details, but their idea is the same idea as with everything with privatization. They just basically think that the private sector can do it better than the state government. But at the same time, critics have been pointing out the fact that, yes, while healthcare costs in the state have been going up, Medicaid costs have actually been going up slower than private insurance companies. So they're wondering how on earth they can shift this into the private sector and expect to save any money.
And at this point, the odds are that it will pass, that this experiment will be approved. Is that your sense of the legislature there?
Yeah, so far, I mean, we have a House and a Senate that are controlled by Republicans as well down here. The House has been fully on board throughout, but the Senate is being extremely careful in how they're looking at it. They forced a slowdown. The governor wanted this to go statewide from the start, it seemed like, from the beginning. They've made it a phased-in sort of approach, and right now it's very unclear whether it's actually going to make it through the legislature for final approval.
But it's getting very close. Alan Gomez in Tallahassee with the Palm Beach Post, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Let me turn now to Pensacola, Florida, and Holly Benson. She is a Florida State Representative, co-chair of the Florida State Legislature's Select Committee on Medicaid Reform. She supports the reform. Holly Benson, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for the invitation.
Why are you pushing for this reform?
Well, over the last 4 years, our Medicaid budget in Florida has grown by about 62%, which is a pretty daunting number when you have other needs that you need to fund, like education and roads and law enforcement. And what we found is, as we worked to spend the $16 billion, we weren't necessarily ensuring good health outcomes for our Medicaid beneficiaries, so it became very clear that we needed to do something different.
Medicaid now accounts for 25% of Florida's state budget. It's an astounding figure, but does this, at bottom, amount to a cutoff or a cap on health care for the poor? This much and you're out.
actually, what you find is Medicaid benefits are already limited. There are only a certain number of mandatory benefits and optional benefits that we are expected to provide. But the reality is that because there are so few providers who are willing to provide those services at the rates that we will pay, access to the health care is severely limited. What we think will happen under reformed Medicaid is we will require the managed care organizations to provide a complete provider panel, and we won't license them until they show that they have adequate providers in place.
And on the other side of that arrangement, it's up to the individual poor person and their provider to work it out. It's no longer the state's problem?
No, I don't think you understand.
Okay.
What will happen is before a plan is licensed, they will have to show that they are providing a certain level of benefits.
Mm-hmm.
Our Agency for Healthcare Administration will evaluate the actuarial equivalency to what is currently offered to those Medicaid beneficiaries who fall into that category and the service level sufficiency. So Medicaid beneficiaries will still receive outstanding benefits. We're working to make sure that we have all the screenings necessary for pregnant women, and early prevention, screening, detection, and treatment for our children will also be protected.
Holly Benson, are you confident this is going to pass the legislature? Will this experiment happen?
I am very optimistic. The reality is that Florida is just like every other state. The growth trends are incredible, and we have to find a way to bring some predictability to this growth level. If we don't find a way to bring these costs under control, then we will continue to eat away at eligibility groups. We will have to consider co-pays, which clearly are a problem for many Medicaid beneficiaries. There'll be limits on prescription drugs. We've done all the nibbling around the edges, and we need to make a change that shows a commitment to the health care for these beneficiaries.
Holly Benson with the Florida State Legislature, thank you very much for joining us. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about American health care for the poor and Florida's out-of-the-box experiment with Medicaid. You can join the conversation. What does it mean that at a time of soaring health care costs, the federal government is cutting support for Medicaid? Is your state struggling under the burden of health care costs for those who cannot afford them? Is Florida right to privatize and cap its Medicaid coverage, or is this an innovative solution, or is it a way to push the problem off the public books? How do you see it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined in this hour from Washington by Joan Alker. She's a senior researcher at the Georgetown University Center for Children and Families. She opposes Florida's Medicaid restructuring. Joan Alker, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And also from Washington, Jim Frog. He is director of the Medicaid Transformation Project, which is part of the Gingrich Group, as in Newt Gingrich. He supports the Florida Medicaid restructuring. He's testified in seven states which are applying to federal Medicaid waivers similar to Florida's. Jim Frog, thanks very much to you for being with us.
Thank you.
Paint the big picture for us as you see it, Mr. Frog, there at the Gingrich Center. What's the problem? How does this kind of experiment begin to address it?
Well, we're very optimistic about this program, the direction that Governor Bush is taking. In the broadest sense, governors who are looking at Medicaid reforms really only have three options in how they deal with Medicaid. And it is a crushing burden financially for states. But more importantly, it's providing care that's substandard for people that are in the program. So governors, broadly speaking, have three choices. They can just do nothing, which is not an option anymore. They can pursue the strategies they've pursued for the last several decades, which is increasing regulations and increasing price controls, or they can pursue consumerism and choice and competition, which has the greatest potential to impact the root of what's wrong with Medicaid, which is consumer behavior, patient behavior.
Consumerism, meaning making patients, what, more responsible for their own health, more vulnerable if their health goes badly and therefore likely to straighten up and fly right, live right?
Well, no, part of it, I mean, it's partly that, but it's partly allowing or creating incentives for people to actually care for themselves better. This isn't about, contrary to some mythology, I think, about excluding anyone on Medicaid, especially the high-cost people. This is about including especially the most expensive and especially the most vulnerable so that they get the care they need at the time they need it so that they are less expensive in the long run and they can enjoy a higher quality of life. And this is a new experiment. It's different. It's trailblazing. without question. And as it goes forward, there's going to be a lot of people watching it. And every state in the country is watching Florida and South Carolina very closely. But we think it has a considerable potential to make real impacts where it matters most, which is improving patient outcomes and therefore lowering costs in the long run.
Joe Nalker, every American can relate to this at some level. Nobody is unaware of how expensive health care coverage is, whether it's the weekly or monthly tab coming out of the paycheck, or the cost that people incur, driven into bankruptcy by healthcare. It's hard to imagine what it's like if you're poor or nearly poor to deal with that situation. Jim Froege says this is the way to do it, to move people from being dependents on Medicaid, let's say, to being healthcare consumers, where they're more likely to look out for themselves for their own health. How do you see it?
Well, I think I would take issue with Jim's point that consumer behavior is driving increases in Medicaid costs. You know, the reason Medicaid costs are going up is for the same reasons that all of our health care costs are going up. Unfortunately, health care costs are going up, and in many ways the Medicaid program helps to make our private insurance work. Medicaid has had to step in for many of the flaws in our health care system. It serves the poorest among us, and it serves the sickest among us, really folks that aren't able to access the private insurance system. And unfortunately, the way I see it, Florida's Medicaid proposal sets the Medicaid program on a path to a new world in which, instead of being guaranteed the medical care they need, people with disabilities and other very vulnerable Medicaid beneficiaries in Florida are instead going to get a fixed amount of money to buy what they can get.
What they can get, whether or not that's enough to address their health needs.
Exactly. And the other problem is that, you know, look, these people's health care needs don't go away just because the state's not going to pay for them anymore. The reality is that their health care costs are still there, and many of the costs will get shifted to other payers in the system, be they hospitals or private insurance premiums that you and I pay.
So what do you think is going on with Florida's move here? What's your, how do you explain the sort of the drive behind it?
Well, I think there's a real ideological interest in privatizing the system. The notion that the private market is better, it very much underpins that. And I think applying this market analogy to Medicaid has some fundamental flaws. First of all, Medicaid is actually less expensive than private insurance. So to privatize the system and saying that you're going to save money without people losing access to services when Medicaid is already cheaper just doesn't add up.
On the other hand, Florida is spending 25% of its state budget on Medicaid. That is an enormous amount of money. What should that state, what should any state do with that kind of burden?
Well, I think all states are facing burdens as a result of their Medicaid program, although a lot of times these numbers are exaggerated because 60% of Florida's dollars are coming in from the federal government.
So you say it would maybe half of that 25%, possibly. Still, it's a huge portion of a budget,
if
that's right.
It's still a huge burden, and to be honest, I'm quite sympathetic to states because I think There are really two reasons why Medicaid programs are under so much stress right now. First of all, as I mentioned, healthcare costs are going up across the board, and if anything, they're going up faster in the private market than they are in Medicaid. Secondly, states have been left holding the bag for the so-called dual eligibles, people who are eligible for Medicare as well as Medicaid. Because there are inadequacies in the Medicare package, both the drug benefit and the long-term care side, states have had to step in and pick up a lot of those costs. And I'm very sympathetic to states. With the aging of our population, over time, that's going to have to change.
But let me just ask you one more thing before I go back to Jim Froege. Millions and millions of Americans live with strictures on their health care that come with their health coverage. Their HMO plan, you know, covers this much and maybe not more. So why is it different for Medicaid recipients if they start to live under I don't know if it's fair to call it similar constraints?
Well, I think there's something very new and different about this program. And what's new and different is that it isn't just more Medicaid managed care. A lot of states already do Medicaid managed care, and in fact, Florida does. But the critical difference here is that it is giving the HMOs and other plans in the system unprecedented flexibility to decide what benefits will people get. And a lot of those decisions will move out of the public eye, and a lot of the risk will get shifted. Look, as you individualize the system, the idea of sharing and pooling risk, which is essential to our health insurance system, mm-hmm. starts to erode, and that's very problematic.
Jim Froege at the Gingrich Group, maybe a decade ago or a little more now, we were all told we're going to shift to HMO kind of coverage, and that will solve our health care problems in this country and the soaring costs. And millions of people shifted, and it did not solve the problem. Why will it solve it for Medicaid?
Because it didn't get to the root of what's wrong. For decades, we've tried government rationing through Medicare and Medicaid. We've tried business rationing. We've tried managed care rationing. And now we're moving towards the place we should have been all along, which is individual rationing. People having the power to make choices and look at the quality of plans, look at the quality of benefits, look at the quality of providers, have transparency in that information and with regard to price and make their decisions that way. Everyone given the choice of having their health care rationed by someone else or by themselves would rather do it themselves, provided, of course, they have the information to make the decisions and the resources to do it.
Are the poor going to be facing tougher rationing than middle-class and upper-class Americans under this plan? Is that moral? How do you see it?
Well, I think with this plan, what it does is it allows benefit flexibility for networks that are participating in the program. And there's a very good chance that the benefits provided could be richer and more robust because, unlike the current Medicaid program, people in Medicaid can change plans if they don't like the service they're getting. There was a point made earlier that Medicaid is less expensive than private plans, and that's largely true. But the reason for that is because Medicaid doesn't have to be competitive. They can just keep cutting their rates and cutting their rates and cutting their rates so it appears that they're less expensive. But that doesn't mean providers are participating in the system.
But people are getting some kind of care. Joan Alker says you're going to throw a sort of blanket of privatization over this whole problem, and then the cuts will be made in the dark under there, and nobody will even know. The poor will pay the price, and it just won't be a public issue.
Well, it has a great opportunity for consumer advocates to be consumer advocates, and we welcome as much light on this process as possible. The more light, the more transparency in how this is going to work, the better. And I think all people can agree.
We clearly have a health care problem in this country, and the poor wrestling perhaps above all with it. We're talking this hour about American health care for the poor and Florida's experiment with Medicaid. They're pushing toward a kind of privatization here. What do you think of it? 1-800-423-8255. Nancy's calling from Natick, Massachusetts. Hi, Nancy. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to make a couple of comments. I was saying that my mother is in a nursing home. She had a stroke. And it took my brother 5 years to get her, and 5 years of diligent work with an elder care lawyer that we had to spend thousands of dollars to advise us to get her even onto Medicaid. And, you know, as a lifelong Democrat, I hate any kind of rationing. But at the same time, you know, something has to be done. It shouldn't have been so difficult. And besides that, you know, she was a retired public health nurse before she got sick, and she was what you would call an educated person as far as medical matters went.
Right.
And, you know, she had some trouble walking or something wrong with her leg or her hip or something, and she went to the doctor, and they ordered a test, and then she went back 3 months later for follow-up, and the guy said, well, I'm going to send you back for another test. Now, the test was like $300, and my mother had to say at that time, that test is not necessary.
Nancy, do you think this would work better under what Florida's contemplating?
I do. Something, you know, it's clearly broken, and I'm no fan of government trimming back these kinds of benefits, you mean, for my mother. You know, I want my mother to be taken care of. But, I have to say that, especially the gentleman that just talked about consumer rationing themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my mother is a nurse, is a medical person, so she knew enough to say. But, I mean, some doctors, you know, ordering a $300 test, I don't know what was in the doctor's mind, but, I mean, ordering a $300 test back-to-back, two visits in a row, doesn't seem like good medicine.
Just cranks up the cost, and you're thinking that maybe an HMO participating in this would not let that happen. Joan Alker, there's a caller saying, look, something's got to happen here.
Something.
Joan, what do you say to Nancy's view?
Well, I think there certainly are ways that we can become more efficient in Medicaid, and actually I would say that some of the changes that the Senate Finance Committee is suggesting are more responsible than what Florida is suggesting. But the reality is that the evidence does not suggest that Medicaid suffers from an overutilization of services. Medicaid beneficiaries aren't going out there and willy-nilly using services just because they want to and not because they need them. So that is why I come back to the point that when the state wants to save money, private plans have to turn a profit. To say that beneficiaries are not going to feel a squeeze here is just not true. It just doesn't add up. Because it supposes there's a lot of fat in the system, and there isn't a lot of fat in the Medicaid system.
I want to ask, with respect, you sound slightly blasé about the cost of this to states and the difficulty they're having in bearing that. Now, people's health is perhaps an unlimited priority. But what about the cost? How does the country ultimately pay for this? How should people think about that, Jim?
Well, I mean, as I said earlier, I think there are two levels to think of this about. I am very sympathetic to states struggle with their Medicaid budgets, in particular, as I mentioned earlier, because I think the Medicaid program is having to hold the bag for a couple of deficiencies in our healthcare system. First of all, the number of uninsured is going up in our country, and Medicaid has been a vital safety net that, for example, has actually decreased the number of children without insurance while the number of adults continues to go up.
Yeah.
Our national policymakers are not addressing that problem, and Medicaid is having to step in and hold up. Do whatever it can. Secondly, as I mentioned, with the aging of our society, more and more Medicaid costs are going to treat just exactly the situation we just talked about, somebody in a nursing home. That's because Medicare doesn't pay for long-term care. And that's not going to be sustainable for states in the long run. But that requires a federal solution. It's not something states can do on their own.
Sounds like a federal response to this may be required at some point. I mean, from the Delphi bankruptcy, the woes at GM over health care costs, everything we see in the private sector, here the state's wrestling with it. What do we do? Kurt's calling from Dubuque, Iowa. Hi, Kurt. You're on the air.
Yeah, good morning. Good conversation. My question, I guess I'd like to turn it towards a bit of a philosophical question, and that's the issue of limits. You used the word unlimited just a second ago.
Yes.
The question for me continues to be, when do we say that it's no longer okay for providers of various equipment and medicines and medical services to just keep charging whatever they choose, and we have to pay it? This is a question of limits in a capitalist system that's larger than this particular sort of microcosmic application. But the issue is, when do we finally say, you know, enough's enough? In the sports world, we've done that a bit with caps on salaries and such.
And you say don't ration health care, but ration health care profits? Is that effectively what you're suggesting?
In essence, I mean, pharmaceutical companies, DME companies have made obscene profits in the past 15 or 20 years.
Kurt, we've got it. And let me put it to Jim Frog here. Jim, how about it? Kurt's turning the telescope around the other way. Americans spend more than any other industrialized nation on health care, and the evidence would seem to be that they don't necessarily get the best overall. So should we be looking at some kind of player salary cap equivalent for the healthcare industry?
Well, I don't think that's the solution. I mean, that's roughly what they do in Canada. And if you hurt your knee jogging in Quebec, you get to wait 6 months for a CAT scan. And I don't think that's what Americans would ever want to have in our country here.
But what about the millions and millions who have no coverage, about the poor who are you know, looking at these constraints, about middle-class Americans who can barely keep up with that payment and then see countries or companies trying to slough it off? I mean, is this still working?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's really the critical issue is, in addition to Medicaid, what do you do about the people who work but don't have coverage for whatever reason? And there's between 40 and 50 million people who at one point during the year fall into that category. And most of the uninsured are people who work or are dependents of those who work. So the question is, do you expand Medicaid up or do you expand private insurance down, or do you blend the two? And one of the things that the Jeb Bush proposal does is it allows Medicaid dollars to be used by patients to buy into their employer's plan if they want to, so that people who have an employer or who work and have a plan offered to them can use their Medicaid dollars to buy into it if they choose. And I think that's an option because it's very important, particularly for people who have chronic conditions and are sicker, that they have continuity of care.
But should Americans be jumping through these hoops, Kurt is asking, when we've seen the kind of profits he refers to, obscene profits in the pharmaceutical industry at different points? I mean, why is all the constraint on one side here? Is it?
Well, no. I mean, I think it has to be a range of issues, but certainly changing people's behavior and how they consume pharmaceuticals is important. One of the things, you know, people talk about restricting consumer advertising or price controls on drugs. The answer to that is for people to see the difference in cost in the drugs. I mean, just because you saw the commercial with the old lady doing karate last night, you want to run out and get that drug the next day. That is a cost driver in the system. But the reason it's a cost driver is because most people have absolutely no idea how much more expensive that drug might be. So if there are more transparency in the pricing, then I think you'd have a lot more, you'd spend a lot less overall.
Kurt in Iowa, thanks for your call. Jim Frog, Joan Alker, stand by. We have to take a short break here. We're talking about American health care for the poor and Florida's out-of-the-box experiment with Medicaid. You can join us. If HMOs didn't solve the health care problem for the rest of the country, can they solve it for the poor? And does health care have to be rationed? Does that mean we'll be accepting less of it for the poor? Is that moral? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com, and Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about American health care for the poor, and maybe by extension for the rest of it. We're looking at Florida's out-of-the-box experiment with Medicaid. What do you think? Is privatizing the way to go, or is it just the appearance of a solution, a way to duck national health care problems embedded right there? We're at 1-800-423-8255, joined in this hour from the Gingrich Group in Washington, as in Newt Gingrich, by Jim Frogue, director of the Medicaid Transformation Project there. From Georgetown University Center for Children and Families, we're joined by Joan Alker. And right now, Nan is calling from Iowa City, Iowa. Hi, Nan. You're on the air.
Hello. I'm calling from Iowa now, but I previously lived in Oregon for many years, and for also many years I was what's called a managed care specialist or an HMO specialist, and I worked for two separate, over the years, large medical clinics.
As a specialist, does that mean you delivered care or you watched over what people were claiming or what care was given?
I was responsible for making sure that there was coverage for services we were about to provide.
Okay.
I worked for an orthopedic clinic, and so there were outpatient surgeries, and they needed all authorization.
So you've got frontline experience there. What do you make of the conversation of what's being proposed here?
I'm seriously concerned about the privatization issue. I disagree with a previous statement made, and I'm not sure who made it, but that patients can simply, if they're not happy with their plan, simply go to another plan. There are many areas, especially in rural places, where there are no other options. You have one option, and it's your HMO. And they can just say, if it was privatized and the corporations can say no, then they will say no if they can, unless they're, feel like there's going to be a lawsuit or something. This happened, to so many patients. I had patients in tears when I had to tell them that their coverage was just not going to be there.
And were these poor patients or just regular sort of covered patients?
No, Medicaid patients.
Medicaid patients who were covered by an HMO or by the traditional Medicaid system?
Well, the intent was to roll everyone into what was called the Oregon Health Plan.
Mm-hmm.
And we were one of the seven pilot states to first have HMOs, and that's when I started doing that position.
Mm-hmm.
And certain high-care patients had a straight Medicaid card, but everyone else had to pick an HMO if there was an option available, or they were just rolled into it.
And you think once this is a done deal, the corporations who are providing that service are just going to deny the service? Nan, stick with us. Jim Frogue, what do you say to that?
Well, I think everyone is concerned about people getting the care they need at the time they need it. But I think this model looks a little bit like what members of Congress themselves sit in. And members of Congress themselves, along with 40 million or 10 million federal employees across the country in the Federal Employees Health Benefits Program, no matter where you live in the country, you have at least a dozen plans to choose from. And that model seems to work. And that includes rural areas, includes urban areas.
And Nan's saying no. She's saying she saw areas where there were not a dozen plans to choose
from. Well, she's not talking about the Federal Employees Program. She's talking about Oregon's Medicaid program.
Mm-hmm.
But people aren't locked into a plan that they don't like. In almost all instances, people like their plan. But if they don't like it, they can change after a year. And that's why if people have multiple choices, there's a much higher likelihood of them actually getting the care that they need. And again, it's very important for consumer advocates and patients and everyone to be involved. If a plan's not providing the services, or if they're denying services that should not be denied, then that should be in the newspaper and on the front page the next day.
We're calling for
a system that has a lot of light on it that everyone can see, and so that the plans that work well should get credit, and those that don't should get in trouble.
Nan, Tom, if I could just jump in here.
Well, I just want to hear from Nan first, if you'd be kind enough, Joan, because
Nan,
you've been on the front line. You hear how Jim Frogue says it. If that poor person in need of health care doesn't get it, the newspaper should put a headline out about it. They'll be okay. They have a lot of choices. What
do you wouldn't say? That be nice? But that doesn't happen. It just doesn't happen. And if it became privatized, I can tell you that it's the CEOs of the corporations, of the health care corporations, that make huge amounts of money, massive, massive dollars. And if they are allowed to make the decisions about what care they will and won't provide, it's going to come down to the bottom line. It's going to come down to the dollar amount. Are they going to still reap their huge profit? And if they're not, they're not going to sign up.
Nan, we just got another second with you. What do you think should happen here? These bills are enormous for states. What's the answer?
Well, I don't think that privatization is the answer. In Oregon, the costs, or what was covered, was dictated by the legislature, and it is on a yearly basis. They say we have this many dollars to allocate, and
yep,
every diagnosis code, everything wrong with the human body has a diagnosis code. And they had a line, and every year the line would change on January 1st, and anything above the line was covered, anything below the line was not.
Cross the line, and good luck to you. Nan, thanks for that firsthand report. We appreciate it. Joan Alker, we hear you there.
I wanted to pick up on a couple of points. First, I think one of the critical issues that Nan identified is how many plans are going to participate in this new Florida proposal. The Blue Cross Blue Shield insurance company in Florida has already indicated they're not going to participate
in
this.
We saw that. Why not?
They say it's too complex, and I also wanted to mention that the Florida Association of Health Plans, which represents the HMO industry, has submitted pages and pages of questions to Governor Bush's administration about this proposal because so many critical details are lacking. They're nervous about it. So that's one of the problems with this proposal. It's being rushed through without adequate time to prepare for it. But the second issue I wanted to raise was something one of your earlier callers mentioned, is that there are responsible ways to save money, particularly in the area of prescription drug pricing. That's actually a lot of the way that the Senate Finance Committee sought to make cuts in the Medicaid program. That would be a more responsible way to save money in the Medicaid program as opposed to cutting services and raising costs for people who are very sick, who have disabilities, chronic medical conditions, and very little money.
Another way to look. Let's take a call from Boston. Robin's on the air. Hi, Robin. You're with us. What do you think?
Well, I'd like to give you a view from the trenches. I'm a primary care physician. I work in the public sector, and many of my patients are elderly immigrants, and many of them are on Medicaid.
Okay.
And I'll give you an example of a patient who has diabetes. She's illiterate. She manages it as best she can. She comes in, her diabetes is way out of control. Why? Eligibility has changed for Medicaid, and she's off Medicaid. I have people with heart disease for which they need the expensive drug. Unfortunately, research is moving so quickly that the expensive drugs are often not always better. If they could be generic, they would be fine, but they're under patent, and they can't get them. And I can't believe you could be saying this is an out-of-the-box solution that to make a profit. That's what America is all about, and the people who pay for it are the poor.
You're saying it's way in the box. When Jim Froak says if people face the kind of constraints that HMOs bring, they'll improve their own personal health behavior. They will be healthier.
I don't know if he's met any of the people I take care of. They have multiple medical problems. Many of them are disabled. Furthermore, the only work they can do may be manual labor, and if they have any kind of orthopedic injury, they can't do that. They don't have the options that most of us calling into this program do. And I think the one thing we're leaving out of this, we've talked about this, is the insurance agencies. What we really need is a national health program. So the profits the drug companies are making and the insurance companies are making actually go to care. There's actually enough money in the system to take care of everybody. Other than that, I think we should have a Canadian-type system.
But Jim says you're going to have to wait 6 months for medical care after you sprain your knee jogging.
Well, that's not an emergency. Is it better for him to get a CAT scan tomorrow while somebody else can't get one at all? Or for an injury like that, should he wait a few months? And also, Canada spends a much smaller percentage of its GNP on health care than we do in the United States.
We're spending a lot, and we're hearing everything that's not okay with that system right now. Robin, thanks very much for your call. Jim Froak, Robin saying this is not out of the box at all. This is profit-seeking by a big, powerful industry.
Well, the caller gave a great indictment of the current system. She talked about her patients who aren't getting the care that they need, who aren't being incentivized to get to treat their diseases they may have correctly. So what we need is a new model. I mean, traditionally, for decades and decades, it's been states, they either cut people, cut reimbursements, cut benefits, or blame Congress. Those are the four solutions to Medicaid. Cut people off the program, whack drug companies or managed care,
right.
Cut benefits from the program, or say Congress is underfunding
but
it.
But Robinson,
we're talking
I've got
about
people who are in such a deep hole, they can't just stand up and shake off their health problems here. And you're saying tough luck if you didn't manage yourself better than that?
No, not at all. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's exactly those people who have the chronic conditions that are the most expensive that need to be included more in the system. Medicaid has a very harsh bias towards reactive and episodic care provided in emergency rooms. What they need is to identify the people who have the multiple chronic conditions, get them in plans that are more personalized so that they can control those diseases, control those ailments, and bring down the cost overall. It's about providing better care first so that things are cheaper, not about whacking providers first in hopes that it'll result in better care.
Jim Frog, let me ask
good you, health is cheaper.
Just quickly, if I may, a lot of concern about upright government lately. The Miami Herald looked at Jeb Bush's record of privatization in Florida, said that his own officials were saying they'd had a mixed record, but said it's been very effective for Jeb Bush politically, that corporations that were contracting out these services that were becoming big contributors to Republican campaigns. I know that Newt Gingrich is very concerned about straight-up honest politics. Are you concerned that if we privatize more huge things like health care, that those contracts are going to become a sort of source of political kickbacks and corruption?
Well, it's interesting also the New York Times in their editorial earlier this week said relatively kind things about Jeb Bush's proposal on Medicaid.
Mm-hmm.
They said it was a different experiment. They thought it was, quote, responsible, and they thought it was something that was worth giving a try. As for the political implications, I'm far less concerned about that than I am about whether or not people are actually getting better care. If you have someone who's 58 years old with three chronic conditions, if they get better care when they need it or they have those conditions identified earlier by a responsible entity and by a person who's incentivized to provide better care, then they'll be cheaper in the long run because they won't be because their conditions won't get out of hand.
Well, watch Florida. That's where the ball is bouncing right now. That's where the worm may turn, and we will be watching. Jim Frog at the Gingrich Group, director of the Medicaid Transformation Project there. Thank you very much for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
And Joan Alker, senior researcher at the Georgetown University Center for Children and Families. Joan, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, the latest on Syrian involvement in the assassination of former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafiq Hariri. This is On Point. The United States, France, and Britain are pushing the UN to turn up the heat on Syria. A draft Security Council resolution circulated yesterday would push Syria to cooperate with the United Nations investigation into the assassination of former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafiq Hariri. The push comes on the heels of a UN investigation implicating top Syrian and Lebanese security officials in the massive bombing that killed Hariri. The new resolution could force Syria to hand over high-ranking suspects for questioning outside the country. It comes at a time when U.S. officials have spoke of transforming relations to the current Syrian regime. Washington Post correspondent Anthony Shadid has been covering the situation in Syria. He joins us from Damascus. Anthony, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
What's going on in Syria in response to this pressure from Washington, from France, from the UK and the UN? Are they feeling the heat? Do they feel like they're really under the gun here?
Well, I think there's no doubt that there's a sense of crisis within the government right now. And I think there's a couple of different tracks that they're taking. I think there is one. President Assad sent a letter over the weekend to the United States, Britain, and France in particular, making a pledge that he would try any Syrian who was proved with concrete evidence to have a role in the assassination. I think on the other hand, though, you're seeing also a wait-and-see attitude. Traditionally, Syrian foreign policy has been reactive. They wait for an action to be taken by the United States, for instance, and then they'll devise a response. And I think we're seeing a little bit of that. I think there is a sense of crisis here and a sense of siege, I think there also is a hope that they can win enough division within the Security Council to forestall sanctions in the immediate term, And then hopefully cooperate to a degree enough that, that placates, say, Russia or China and avoids even more dramatic sanctions down the road.
Is there a sense in Syria that, that Damascus is now an active target for regime change, Washington-style, Iraq-style, with or without military intervention?
I think there is a I think there's clearly a sense within the government that the United States would want to see this government gone, but doesn't necessarily have an alternative. I think this government sees this as a crisis unlike any they've faced in the past. Even when you look back to the Arab-Israeli wars, there wasn't necessarily a question over the survival of the government itself. That is in question right now, and that is being something that's talked about rather openly. I think there's no question the government sees this as a crisis, and there are divisions within the government on how to respond to it. I think when you get to the street, I think when you talk to people, their fear is probably more, what are American intentions specifically towards Syria? In other words, I think a lot of people do see shades of Iraq right now, shades of Iraq in early 2003, before the U.S. invasion. And I think what you hear voiced most often is this prospect, there's this anxiety over the prospect of instability, over the prospect of chaos. Say the government does fall, then what comes, what follows? And this is a very complicated society, a bit as complicated as Iraq. And I think there's a deep, deep sense of unease over what would happen if there was going to be a lot of instability.
If Syria's balancing act doesn't work, if the Security Council reaches into Damascus, pulls out very senior officials to question them abroad, perhaps to hold them accountable for murder, would that crack the Syrian government?
Well, see, that's a good question. I think that's what a lot of people are debating here. You know, the simple idea of questioning Syrian officials abroad is probably something that the government will agree to. I mean, these guys are professionals, the people that they're talking about. They're going to know. They're going to be able to keep their story straight. They're going to know what to say. It doesn't run all that great of a risk by simply agreeing to let these people be questioned outside the country. The next step, though, is what becomes much more decisive. If these people are implicated in the assassination with very direct evidence, and some diplomats here say the evidence is a little bit scant right now over Syrian involvement, but if they're implicated, then that becomes a very decisive moment for the government. Can the government, and when we talk about the government, we're talking about an inner circle that's very tight, that's mainly family, two brothers, a brother-in-law and a sister that make the key decisions. Would they be willing to split the family to turn people over? Most people think they wouldn't. And so that leaves a lot of people asking the question, how does this crisis get resolved? And a lot of people, I think most people you talk to, can't really offer a scenario with a lot of confidence on how this crisis would be resolved.
Tony, we've just got half a minute. If this shaking and baking should lead to a regime change in Damascus, does that lead to a more stable or more chaotic Middle East?
Well, I think one of the big legacies of authoritarianism in the Middle East that you've seen over 20 or 30 years has been, basically the depoliticization of society. The parties, political parties, movements, civil society, it's just not there in these societies right now. And so there isn't a ready-made alternative. And I think that's what the very weak and feeble Syrian opposition is trying to articulate. Is an alternative. But I think if you ask most people in this country, do they see one right now, they would say most definitely not.
The pressure on Damascus right now and maybe mounting. Anthony Shadid, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Anthony Shadid, correspondent for The Washington Post. He spoke with us from Damascus. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.